Webcasting around the world from the desert metropolis of Phoenix, Arizona, this is The Dividing Line. The Apostle Peter commanded Christians to be ready to give a defense for the hope that is within us, yet to give that answer with gentleness and reverence. Our host is Dr. James White, Director of Alpha and Omega Ministries and an elder at the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. This is a live program, and we invite your participation. If you'd like to talk with Dr. White, call now at 602-973-4602. Or toll-free across the United States, it's 1-877-753-3341. And now, with today's topic, here is James White.
And good morning. Welcome to The Dividing Line. Good to be back here in Phoenix, Arizona. Really wasn't gone for a whole long time, really, but very, very appreciative to everyone who participated in making the debate Thursday evening so successful. Especially those who were there, who pitched in and gave of their time and their effort there. People like, I already put everybody on the website, but especially Eric Nielsen, who had to receive the camera that we shipped back there, and Dale and Brigand and Algo and all the guys that were there and assisted in getting the recording done. As you will see here in a few moments, the recording sounds great. And Lord willing, later today, you should see something on the blog announcing the availability of the high-quality MP3 recording of the debate. And then hopefully not too far beyond that, we'll be able to put the DVDs together. And what will the MP4 come before the DVD, maybe? Or sound around the same time, something like that? Okay. And since we did the recording, in fact, if you want to add something to your list of things to pray about, I haven't been able to say much about this yet, but you may notice that the last about 8 debates that I did, other than the Ehrman debate, we've never made them available because we've never received them. And I discovered this past week that that's because the folks who recorded them can't pay to get them from the videographers. And so we may need to put up an item and maybe do it somewhere along the lines of pre-sales of them to try to raise some funds and make it more than normal. You know, I don't know what we'll have to do, but we'll have to find some way of being of assistance to get, as I count them, 8, because I forgot about the ones, 9. The ones from California, we've also never received either, like with the debate with Farhan Qureshi. So I think there are 9 videos of debates that are just sort of in limbo right now because the folks that record them cannot pay to get them back from the videographer. And so we're going to have to do something to help out there because you don't do 9 debates and let them just disappear because people don't have money to pay for them. So we got to find some way of working that out. But anyway, we did the recording on this one, so we have the tapes. And so they'll be available tout suite, as they say, and very high quality, as you will see. So thanks to all those folks. And, of course, a great amount of thanks to those who made it possible. We footed the bill for me on this one. That is, we paid for the hotel and the airport, the airline tickets and the rental car and et cetera, et cetera. So you contributed to making that happen, and it was a real honor to meet a number of you who were there at the debate. I heard a number of people say, "How come you don't come to the Midwest more often?" Well, I go where I'm invited, you know. I mean, this whole debate just came about because, and I don't remember, excuse me, now what, I don't know what caused me to go looking for Barker Wilson debate. I don't remember what prompted that. Why I put that on my iPod and was listening to it. I don't recall now, but I did, and it was after that that E. Nielsen and Channel said, "Hey, I just got I was just contacted. Some students at the University of Illinois are looking for someone to debate Dan Barker. Anybody know anybody around here would do that?" And I remember saying, "I will." "You will?" "Yeah, I think that would be great." So that's how that all ended up working out anyway. And so we are so thankful when folks help us to do those things. It's extremely encouraging when folks stand with us. And as a result, the evening was a great evening. Obviously, I continue looking forward to that grand day. When I will debate someone who comes from a liberal perspective, and that person from the liberal perspective will have the attitude that says, you know, maybe I ought to do some homework for this debate. Maybe I ought to find out what James White actually believes. Maybe I'd like to read one of his books. Maybe just one. Not all of them, but just one. Maybe some that's relevant. Maybe I ought to listen to some of his debates, maybe, that he's done with other people. Do something other than just show up and repeat the exact same presentation I've made over and over and over again. Now, don't get me wrong. I hope that I'm consistent in the presentations that I make. And you're going to hear similarities. I mean, if I debated another atheist next year, I would probably use many of the same elements of my presentation. But when you use the exact same notes, when you're debating Kyle Butz, now I don't know what Kyle Butz's background is, but it sounded to me like he was at a Church of Christ. Okay. Something along those lines. I could be wrong. I haven't looked it up. But very clearly, Mr. Butz's presentation, his perspective is very different than my own. He's not Reformed, as far as I could tell. And so when you use the exact same notes, the exact same text, and the exact same order, for people who are coming from very different perspectives, what do you expect? And in this particular debate, even if, let's just say for the sake of argument, that Dan and I are equivalent speakers, with equivalent experience in debate. And Dan does not even Google my name. When I talked to him before the debate, he said, oh, you are the same James White. So he hadn't even looked me up, had no idea where I was coming from, if I had published anything, if what I'd taught, anything like that. What did I do? Well, if you listen to The Dividing Line, you know, over the past month and a half, you've probably gotten sick and tired of Dan Barker, but I've played numerous debates. We've gone through his points point by point. I've gotten his books. I've not only listened to his debates once, probably more than once, a number of them. I know I listened to the Paul Menard and Doug Wilson debates at least three times each, maybe more. And so if you've got two equivalent people, one does their homework and one does not, what do you expect is going to be the outcome of that particular encounter? Well, I think that was the outcome of that particular encounter. And, yeah, look at that. London Truth just said, Kyle Butz is with Apologetics Press, a publishing arm of the Church of Christ. So he used the exact same argumentation, with a Church of Christ, defender as he does with a Reformed Baptist. Now, maybe to Dan, it just doesn't matter. And in fact, let me give you an insight from, what you don't see on the video or hear on the video. The navigators there at the University of Illinois took me out to lunch. The day of the debate, and I met with a group of them and did a lot of talking. That's at least I did get to eat. Frequently, when that happens, I don't get to eat, and because there are too many questions being asked. But I did get to have some of that yummy Chicago-style pizza at a rather famous pizzeria just down the road. And so I was just going through what I expected the debate to be about, and I was telling them about Dan. And, in essence, I said, well, you know, here's some of his favorite arguments. He's got this list of contradictions. Here's some of the contradictions. I talked about John alleged contradiction. My testimony is not true. My testimony is true. I went through that. They sort of laughed, like, people actually think that's a contradiction. I said, yeah, I bet, you know, he's said it many times. Well, oh, okay. And, then I talked about his, I only believe in one less God than you do. And I said, you know what? Today is Thursday. I said, I have a feeling that he will use his Thursday, illustration. Today, you know, people used to worship God Thor. They heard thunder, blah, blah. So I went all through this stuff with the students. So when Dan gets up for his opening presentation and says, well, you know, today is Thursday, and that's the God Thor, and la 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 la, and then he goes through the Christian, the triune God does not exist because, and then he goes through the exact same contradictions in the exact same order that we've dealt with him here on the program, and that he did in the Kyle Butz debate. I'm just looking out at the navigators who are sitting, I don't know, six rows back or so, on the right-hand side, and they're all just sitting there smiling broadly because they're like, wow. It reminded me of the first time I debated Jerry Matatix on Long Island, and Chris Arnes and I, who you know, Chris and I had just met for the first time, and we're sitting at dinner, and he says, what do you expect this evening? So I started going through, and I started saying, well, you know, Jerry likes to show up, and he likes to talk about how all his books are in boxes, and he's rushed to get here, and all he's done is had, you know, a Coca-Cola and a cupcake or something, and that all he had time to do was scribble some notes on a yellow pad while he was driving here, and blah, 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 blah. And I remember Chris looking at me like, really? Oh, come on, you know. And then I remember the expression on Chris's face when Jerry started his opening statement. And it was like I had written it for him. And he knew from that point on that it was going to be fine. He was so nervous before that, but he knew from that point on it was going to be fine because I had predicted exactly what Jerry Mattox would say in his opening statement. And, you know, that doesn't make me right, but it does demonstrate that I do my homework. If I'm going to be debating someone and I can do homework on them, if they've published something, recorded something, I take the time to find these things out. For some reason, my opponents do not return that favor, and that's their disadvantage. You know, someday someone's actually going to, you know, debate me and actually have read what I had to say, and that'll be fine. That'll be wonderful. But anyhow, I thought the debate went very, very well. I have queued up for me, just to give you an idea of the quality of the sound. I have queued up for me and for you, the closing statement that I made, where I attempted to make some application. And, I don't feel like my position was seriously, interacted with or criticized, by Mr. Barker because he just, I'm sorry, but a one size fits all presentation of atheism, naturalistic materialism, versus a presuppositional approach that also, in this instance, presented evidence, not as a neutral fact, and I blogged about this yesterday, not as a neutral fact from which we derive the existence of God, but as an evidence of Mr. Barker's inability to deal with the reality around him because of his dogmatic assertion of materialism. I had presented evidence from design, and as I expected, Mr. Barker's responses were insufficient to deal with the realities of the facts, that the facts of science point us beyond the natural realm. And as long as you just sit there and say, nothing outside the materialistic realm exists, and I'm not going to even consider these things, well, you can see the circularity into which that kind of denial forces the naturalistic materialist. So and before I play this, I did want to mention one other thing because I'm probably going to forget it because I've got a million things going through my mind here. I've got my Kindle over here. I wanted to read just something. I wanted to talk about some other issues I want to get to here. So a bunch of stuff flying through the mind this morning. But as I was heading out to Illinois, I think it's as I got there, another illustration here of just how thankful I am to just be one little small part of the body of Christ across the world. And I have mentioned before, and I don't want to embarrass my brother, but there are just people in this world that you just you just get along. You just, there's a connection. You know, I was talking to a visitor at church on Sunday, and I was talking to him about the ministry, and he's followed the ministry for about 6 years, and is very thankful for it and things like that. And he was just visiting because he's doing some work in Phoenix, and so we had a nice visit. And I was talking about, well, I said, you know, I pointed over, and Brother Rich was holding forth about, what, 5-10 feet away from me. You all were talking about something, politics, as I recall. I forget what it was about, but Rich was holding forth to a group of about 4 or 5 folks. And so I pointed over to Rich. I said, well, you've got the entire staff of the ministry within 10 feet of each other here. And I could tell he was a little bit surprised at how small the church is. People, I think, come and expect some big mega church, and Reformed Baptist churches do not fit into the mega church mold very well. They just not don't fit there very well. Anyway, and I was I was talking about how I was just so thankful there are people that, you know, you just get along with, you have harmony with. I had talked about Pastor Fry and how, interestingly enough, Pastor Fry and I said a lot of the exact same thing Sunday morning, but we never talked about it. It just so happened in the synoptic study that we were in Luke chapter 12 about contentment, And so I had sort of just done a little mini sermonette, basically, without much in the way of preparation on it, about contentment and covetousness and so on and so forth in Sunday school. And then Pastor Fry is in the Sermon on the Mount, and he was in the same section. About how the Lord will take care of us and worry can't add to our stature and things like that. And we ended up saying almost the exact same things, but we had no communication beforehand about it. That has happened many, many times. And that's a great blessing to me. And then I said, you know, look at Rich here and I. We're like an old married couple. You know, we just, he does his thing. I do my thing. We know exactly what our jobs are. There's no, egos involved and all the rest of that stuff. And we've been doing that for 20 years. And I couldn't do what I do without him, and it's just how it works. And the same thing is true about my brother Roger Brazier in London. Roger and I don't get to talk as much as we probably, I think, I certainly would enjoy doing. But that's probably because he's in London and I'm here, and there's a 8-hour difference between us now. And so he had sent me an email, I think right as I got to the University of Illinois. He says, I'm sure you've got everything ready to go, and say, but I thought you might find this interesting. He sent me a PDF of a portion of a book called Why Us by James LeFanu. And I hadn't seen the book. It's a brand new book. And I read the PDFs and I was just blown away. Because LeFanu is not some fundamentalist Christian or something. I don't even get the feeling he's a Christian at all. But in essence, what he's expressing is that naturalistic materialism is getting beaten about the head and shoulders by the scientific advances that are taking place in our day, specifically focused upon the human genome studies. Well, actually, not just the human genome studies, but the genome studies of the fly and various other animals that have been done, the mapping of the genome of these living creatures. And the year of the brain, the explosion in neuroscience study that have been more introduced to that because the guest I had on week before last that was visiting, Jamin Huebner, graduate of Dort, has really gotten into studying that particular area, and so he's also one of our channel regulars and talked about that a good bit in channel and so on and so forth. And via other means, I have been aware of his study of that particular field. Anyway, that's what the book's about. And so I actually was so taken by what I read that, and this is another thing to be thankful for, I have an Amazon Kindle, the Kindle 2. And so I found out that it's available in that format, and voila, boom, got it. It is amazing today. The technology that we have that I purchased, I think, 3 books in one day on my Kindle that I was using for finishing up my presentation for the University of Illinois debate. And I'm going to read some sections from that, and you'll hear that in the debate as well when you get it. But it was just so encouraging to me that my brother Roger in London, when I first went there, within 5 minutes, it felt like we had known each other all of our lives, and we just had that connection as Christians, and we think along the same lines. And for some reason, he will not take credit for my English accent. That's the one thing I don't understand. I've tried to model it off of him, and for some reason, he just recoils from that. But other than that, we get along really well, and obviously think along the same lines. And so I ended up incorporating a whole section into my opening presentation from that book once I had it on my Kindle and I could quote it directly. I think when I read some of that section, you'll see that. But again, just another one of those very encouraging things. The group of people that met me after the debate, some of whom have helped in getting me those resources that I can use. Very, very encouraging all the way around the line. So, it's great to see the Lord working that way. Let me go ahead and play this section here so you can see some of the quality that we were able to get. Again, thanks to E. Nielsen and Brigand and Dale and Algo and everybody, making sure that, we had the right, sound equipment connected to the camera and all the rest of that stuff. Here's, after I gave Dan a couple of, gifts. I gave him the Ehrman DVD. and I gave him a chess book, which he said he already had, so he could give to a friend of his. But again, just demonstrating, I read his book, and I know what he's interested in, and was just trying to demonstrate some kind of, I know Calvinists aren't supposed to do this, but human compassion in being nice and bringing those resources for him. Then after doing that, we picked up with the closing statement, which was this.
The New Testament presents to us an absolutely unique message. All of the pagan religions had no concept of what the New Testament says to us. That's why it was such an amazing and startling message in its context. As a monotheistic religion, Christianity teaches that there is one God who is timeless, who by the exercise of his will created all things, time, space, and matter. But he is not subject to these things. He is not connected to these things in the sense that he is dependent upon them. That monotheistic God, for his purposes, chose to glorify himself in a triune fashion. Dan said, I didn't connect the dots for you. Well, I made it as part of my opening presentation. He never challenged any of it. Specifically, the fact that God is triune demonstrates that the personal relationships of Father, Son, and Spirit have always been there. God has always been love. He did not become love in creation. Creation was not necessary to him. Without the Trinity, you have all sorts of issues regarding necessity in the being of God. But as I pointed out, the Bible reveals this about God. And it reveals to us that the Trinity as a whole chose to bring about the drama of redemption. It was not the Father who became incarnate, it was the Son. It's not the Son who dwells in the people today, it's the Son by the Spirit that does so. These are biblical teachings that the New Testament is very clear on. And it is absolutely amazing what the Christian is actually saying. Yes, we are saying that the one who created all things, who literally holds all things together, became a carpenter in Galilee. Amazing, stupid, foolish. That's exactly what the New Testament says. Those who are perishing believe. It's foolishness. It's foolish. It's a scandal to the Jew who is seeking after signs. It's a scandal to the Gentile who is seeking after wisdom. But God has chosen the foolishness of the message that is preached to be the means by which he saves those who believe. Now, when I look at creation around me, and I was a science major, I was a double major in college, Bible and biology, as department fellow in anatomy and physiology. As a senior, I raised over 35,000 Drosophila melanogaster fruit flies. Anybody raised fruit flies in here? Are they still, does the fly nap still stink as bad as it used to? It does? Okay, all right. I studied genetics, and I was fascinated by it. And when I look at what happens in our bodies, when I look at the complexity, I am not sitting here going, oh, that complexity must mean God is there. I'm not talking about trying to fill God into the gaps. I am recognizing that the complexity that is there is not a snowflake complexity. It is not a crystal complexity. It is the same complexity that is containing in the hard drive of that MacBook Pro over there, the keynote presentation that I made at the beginning of this presentation. And if I fire Keynote up again, guess what? It's going to give the same presentation. The data has order, it contains information, and it's repetitive. And that's what we see in the design around us. You know who really introduced me to intelligent design? It was Dawkins. You see, I graduated in 1985, completed my major in biology, and then I read The Blind Watchmaker. Now, I had gone to a Christian school, but I was the only non-evolutionist in the biology department. So I had fought this battle for a long time. I've read the best evolution has to offer. And I read The Blind Watchmaker. And it was in reading that I came to the realization that single-step micromutation cannot create complex systems. It just can't do it. Because every single mutation has to give some type of reproductive help to the being in which it's contained. And you can't do that when the most minimal system will require 10, 15, 20 steps.
By the way, the word I was searching for there was advantage. It just...
That's what caused me. I had never even heard of the term intelligent design. Never even read anything about it. It was reading The Blind Watchmaker that forced me to recognize that. Now, Dan Barker's a very bright man. You still a member of the Prometheus Society? 99.997, is that what it has to be?
They haven't kicked me out
They haven't kicked you out yet? Okay. 99, an IQ of in the 99.997th percentile. That makes Dan a very intelligent man. No one's questioning that this evening. I question his exegesis, and I can give good grounds of that, but that's a different issue. How can he and I look at the same data and come to such different conclusions? He would say, well, it's because you're religious. And I say to Dan, oh, so are you. My, you have demonstrated that this evening. There is such a strong commitment on his part. He said, I was once a fundamentalist. I think Dan still is. He's just switched gods. He has fundamentalistically clung to his naturalistic materialism, and anything that would point beyond the borders of that materialism must be denied. And I simply say to you, who has borrowed whose worldview this evening? Why should Dan, as Doug Wilson put it, complain that God's pro-choice in Psalm 137? If that's what he was complaining about. If that's what God is. Why should he raise those issues? Why does he tell us this evening that there is no transcendent meaning and purpose to life? You know what my hope this evening is? Very quickly, I met with a young man a number of years ago at a university here in Illinois, up to the north. We had a long conversation about his atheism, and when he left, I said to him, you know, I think you're going to take that jacket with you when you leave. He had denied whether that jacket really existed or not. I think you're going to take that jacket with you leave because it's cold outside. And I think you're going to drive down the right-hand side of the road, and I think you're going to live a life where you're going to every single day have to borrow from my worldview to make yours work. And Dan Barker is a brilliant man, and I'm going to hold him to sending me one of your CDs. I want to hear your piano playing because I'm sure it's beautiful. But my hope and prayer is that when Dan Barker sits down at the keyboard and he produces that which is objectively and transcendently beautiful, he's going to realize that he's doing it. That he's not going to cheapen it by saying, oh, well, this is only beautiful because of certain reactions in my brain. That beauty is real beauty. Meaning is real meaning. Purpose is real purpose. And after you and I are gone, those things will still be true, valid, beautiful, and right. I submit to you that no society will last long that doesn't believe those things. And no person will ever find true fulfillment until they know those things. Thank you very much for being here this evening.
And I should note that as I checked out of the Union Hotel the next morning to come home, there at the front desk was Dan Barker's CD, which he had left for me. As he had promised to do. And if you were listening to the pre-feed before the program, that's what you were listening to, was Dan Barker. And yes, he's very good, as I expected him to be. And that story that I told about the young man that was from Bradley University, I've told that story on The Dividing Line before. I think I talked about it when I got back. Was a young atheist with whom I had a lengthy conversation, and once again I with him demonstrated the nature of the presuppositional commitments he was making and how he would not live in accord with them, that he could not live in accord with them, and it bothered him to no end, and I hope it continues to bother him to this day unless the Lord's had mercy upon his soul and has drawn him to his Son since then. And so there was the end of the debate. And I again, very thankful for everyone who made it possible for us to do that. As I haven't heard anything from these folks for a couple days, but there is a real possibility anyways, that I'll be debating Dan again in September. And what I have suggested to the folks who are doing putting the material together, the conference together, and to Dan at this debate, was that we go through his list, that list that he has put in print. He's put it in multiple debates. He's put it in print. Let's go through that list. Let's give him a certain amount of time to present the alleged contradictions. Give me more time to respond, because obviously on any rational level, it takes more time to respond to an accusation of error than it does to make an accusation of error. But let him present his best shots, and I'll respond to them. That's what I would like to see done, because he said actually he did that with somebody once. I've never heard it. I've not heard that particular debate. He said it took 3 days or something like that. But I would obviously, from my perspective, I have never heard Dan Barker present a meaningful alleged contradiction. I just haven't. You have to use a very simplistic, surface-level form of eisegesis to make his alleged contradictions work, and I don't believe they do. And I would be willing to demonstrate that. So we'll see if that comes up. Got more to say. Get to the LeFanu book here after we take our break. 877-753-3341. We'll be right back.
BibleWorks 8 is here. Full of innovative and essential tools, users will have 190-plus Bible translations, 35 original language text and morphology databases, 29 lexical grammatical references, and an abundance of additional resources. Pastors, you'll appreciate the phrase matching tool, which will allow you to find all of the verses containing phrases similar to your search verse, giving you greater depth and keener insight during sermon preparation. Seminary professors and students will be enriched by the way BibleWorks 8 shows the most common words in the pericope, book, or chapter, plus provides a wider range of formatting options and faster access to copying preferences. Scholars, your research just got easier with the ERMI, External Resources Manager, a handy tool to collect, organize, and display resource files from your computer as well as the internet. Dr. James White says, BibleWorks is the best Bible software available. I have used BibleWorks software for years, and each new release has brought many new and useful tools to the program. This is the program that runs 24/7 on my office computer, and it is the one that's running on my laptop when I engage in debates. It is simply the number one research tool for anyone doing serious exegesis of the text. For over 15 years, BibleWorks has assisted all users in their study of the original languages, and that enables you to do one thing, focus on the text. And that translates to focusing on the truth. Order your copy of BibleWorks at aomen.org, and for a limited time, you'll receive free shipping and a free MP3 download of the White Airman Debate.
The history of the Christian Church pivots on the doctrine of justification by faith. Once the core of the Reformation, the Church today often ignores or misunderstands this foundational doctrine. In his book, The God Who Justifies, theologian James White calls believers to a fresh appreciation of, understanding of, and dedication to the great doctrine of justification, and then provides an exegesis of the key scripture texts on this theme. Justification is the heart of the gospel. In today's culture, where tolerance is the new absolute, James White proclaims with passion the truth and centrality of the doctrine of justification by faith. Dr. J. Adams says, "I lost sleep over this book. I simply couldn't put it down." James White writes the way an exegetically and theologically oriented pastor appreciates. This is no book for casual reading. There is solid meat throughout, an outstanding contribution in every sense of the words. The God Who Justifies by Dr. James White. Get your copy today at aomen.org.
Hello, everyone. This is Rich Pierce. In a day and age where the gospel is being twisted into a man-centered self-help program, the need for a no-nonsense presentation of the gospel has never been greater. I am convinced that a great many go to church every Sunday, yet they have never been confronted with their sin. Alpha and Omega Ministries is dedicated to presenting the gospel in a clear and concise manner, making no excuses. Man is sinful and God is holy. That sinful man is in need of a perfect Savior, and Jesus Christ is that perfect Savior. We are to come before the holy God with an empty hand of faith in the Lord Jesus Christ. Alpha and Omega takes that message to every group that we deal with, while equipping the body of Christ as well. Support Alpha and Omega Ministries and help us to reach even more with the pure message of God's glorious grace. Thank you.
And welcome back to The Dividing Line. Before we get back to LeFanu and a few things like that, just real quickly, I had quite a privilege Saturday evening. To meet and listen to speak Father Zachariah Butros. Now, some of you know who he is. Some of you do not. If you get World Magazine, you saw that he was the 2008 Daniel of the Year. He is basically known as Father Zachariah in the Arabic-speaking world. He is one of the most recognized faces and names in Middle Eastern countries. He has a television program on the Life satellite channel, and he certainly has the largest Muslim audience of anybody in the world. Why? Because as a Christian, he knows the Quran and the Hadith like the back of his hand. And he speaks in Arabic, and he drives the Muslims crazy. I understand there is, I think the World Magazine article said as high as a $60 million bounty on his head provided by Al-Qaeda, mainly Saudi oil money. And even though Al-Qaeda and Saudi don't seem to go together, but things are always mixed up over there. They can all get together in their detestation of Zakaria Butros. He is an elderly Coptic priest, and because of the bounty on his head, there has to be a great care taken in where he goes and where he speaks and the security. We had to have tickets to this event. There wasn't a bunch of discussion of it beforehand. And I was very thankful that when I got there, most of the people who were putting on the program knew who I was. That always surprises me. They were aware of what we've been doing in regards to Islam. That was very exciting. And I had brought a few things to give to him, or at least have given to him. I didn't know how things were going to be working that evening. The entire evening was in Arabic. And I didn't pick up one of the little translation thingies. I just used it as an opportunity to practice. So I had mentioned that I had the two books. I had my book on the Trinity and my book on justification. I had the Ehrman debate and one of the Shabir Ali debates on DVD. And so while the singing was going on, and I was transfixed on the digital projection because I was trying to read the Arabic and wasn't doing half a bad job. I didn't know what half the words meant. But since people were singing, I was able to go, okay, there's that, you know, and so I'm just following along. I'm just doing lots of Arabic practice is what I'm doing. And while that was happening, one of the leaders came up and said, "You have your books, the things you have with you, yeah, grab them." And they took me back alone into a back room where I had a few moments to talk with Father Zechariah. And I gave him the materials, explained what they were, and I was again, rather surprised that he had any idea who in the world I was. Maybe they just told him, but I didn't get that feeling. I thought he actually had heard of what we were doing. And he specifically said, "We need many more people in the West who are doing what you're doing and exposing Islam and in debating these issues and providing the kind of debates and so on and so forth." So we had a nice conversation before he then came out and spoke in Arabic. That was without something to look at. Very obviously for me, my reading is much better than my listening. Oh, I could pick stuff up, especially when he was talking about a biblical text, because the biblical text would be put up there. And so I knew where he was quoting from. So I had some idea what was going on. But especially when I could tell he was going off into telling a story, until I couldn't get a context at all, it was just like, eh, whatever. So that was very interesting to get a chance to meet him and to listen to him speak and to watch the people. He's really a beloved figure amongst Arabic Christians, certainly not amongst Muslims. But anyway, and then a completely different topic, and that is if I was not teaching during this very same period of time, and I could swing it. There is going to be the Midwest Center for Theological Studies, their June term 2009, for those of you that are in the area. June 1st through 6th, 2009, the Midwest Center for Theological Studies in Owensboro, Kentucky. For those who can get it, it's $250 for MCTS students, $100 for auditors. The registration deadline is Friday, May 22nd, 2009, and that is a course on preaching to... A course on biblical preaching will be taught by Tom Askell, June 1st through 6th, 2009. If you are in that area or you'd like to get some real good teaching on biblical preaching, then Tom Askell will be doing that. Like I said, if I wasn't teaching myself, that would be something that would be tempting to me simply because Tom is a great speaker, a great preacher, and I think you would all enjoy that. So if you have an opportunity, you might want to sign up for that. Now, as I was saying, I was looking at the Lefanu book called Why Us, And let me just read you just a section here. I think you'll see why it is a book I would recommend to you. It's not written by a Christian, but I've actually bought two copies for some young people that I know to read. I can't give you page numbers because that is one of the disadvantages to the Kindle, is that the electronic version is different. This is locations 2126 through 2129 if you have a Kindle, about 41% through the text of the book. Well, you can't do that with a paper book, can you? Anyways, he is comparing and contrasting a pebble at the bottom of a stream with a fly that is on the surface of the stream. And just this section really, really struck me as I was reading it. But this contrast between the outer physical appearance of fly and pebble is merely the beginnings of the differences between them. For the fly, or any form of life, is fashioned from successively more fundamental organizational levels or layers of increasing complexity. I didn't think about this when I was reading it, but I just heard Donkey talking about an onion for some reason, for those of you who know what I'm referring to there. Anyway, first, the organs such as the heart, brain, and gut. Those organs, in turn, are fashioned from the unique arrangement of nerves, muscles, and glands that make up the tissues. The tissues themselves are fashioned from the most fundamental unit of life, the cell, at which point, if we were to step inside, we would find ourselves in a world of supreme technology. We would see endless corridors branching in every direction, along which a huge range of products, proteins, enzymes, and raw materials, chemicals, shuffle in a highly ordered fashion to and from all the various assembly plants, writes biologist Michael Denton. We would wonder at the level of control implicit in the movement of so many objects, all in perfect unison. We would see that nearly every feature of our own advanced machines has its analog in the cell. Memory banks for information storage and retrieval, elegant control systems regulating the automated assembly of parts, proofreading devices utilized for quality control, assembly processes involving the principle of prefabrication and modular construction. This automated factory carries out almost as many unique functions as all the manufacturing activities of man on Earth, but with one capacity not equaled in any of our most advanced machines. It is capable of replicating its entire structure within a matter of a few hours. And yet the cell, this remarkable piece of machinery that possesses the capacity to construct every living thing that has ever existed, is several thousand million, million, million times smaller than the smallest piece of functional machinery ever constructed by man. Nor does it stop there. For the properties of the humble fly on the surface of his pond belong in a dimension that has no parallel with the inanimate pebble, the capacity to transform the nutrients on which it feeds into its own tissues, to repair its parts and reproduce its kind. The humble fly is, in short, billions upon billions upon billions of times more complex than the pebble. The history of biology over the last 400 years is essentially the progressive and purposive unraveling in successive ways of discovery of the ever more fundamental layers of the complexity of life, from the descriptive anatomy of the whole organism in the 17th century through the physiology, histology, embryology, and biochemistry of the 18th and 19th centuries, culminating in the penetration over the last 60 years of the mysteries of the cell and the instructions determining the form of all living things strung out along the double helix, that is, DNA. There is nowhere further for biology to go. This is the end of the line, and just as the fly is so vastly more complex than the pebble, so the directive force, the genetic instructions, the double helix must, when compared to Newton's physical laws of matter, be billions upon billions upon billions of times more potent. The deciphering of those genetic instructions would be biology's last great task. How do they impose form on living things? How do they replicate themselves to be transmitted from one generation to the next? How might they change so that one form of life is transformed into another? There is no profounder question. There are no profounder questions. Their elucidation over the past 150 years has come in three major installments. It began, as already touched on, with Mendel's famous P experiments, which revealed how the characteristic traits of living things are passed down from one generation to the next in the form of genes, for the most part fixed and unchanging, ensuring that the offspring of cats will always be kittens, except for the occasional, usually harmful, mutation. The second installment began in 1953 when Francis Crick and James Watson discovered that those genes are strung out along the two intertwining strands of the double helix, each strand a sequence of just four chemicals that so far we have portrayed as colored discs, but which commonly designated by the first letters of their names, C for cytosine, G for guanine, A for adenine, and T for thymine. Christopher Wills, professor of biology at the University of California, draws an appropriate analogy. I have just with some difficulty hefted Webster's third New International Dictionary onto my lap. This is the one that you see in libraries sitting proudly on its own little lectern. I find that there are about 60 letters to a line, 150 lines to a column, and three columns to a page. This works out at 27,000 different letters to a page. The dictionary has roughly 2,600 pages, adding up to 70 million letters in all. Since there are about 3 billion letters in the human genome, it would take 43 volumes the size of this enormous dictionary, filling a shelf 12 feet long, to list the information that they carry. In reality, of course, those C, G, A, and T chemical molecules are minuscule compared with the letters representing them. So when strung together along the double helix, they produce a continuous strand of approximately 3 inches, or 75 millimeters long. But those 75 millimeters must be packed into the nucleus of the cell, which is about 1/500th of a millimeter across. The double helix, in achieving this extraordinary feat, packs over 100 trillion times as much information by volume as the most sophisticated computerized information system ever devised. Let me just stop there for a moment. Maybe you're like me. If you're near my age, you are amazed at what we can do today. You're amazed at the SD card, or now with my BlackBerry Storm, the micro SD card. I've got a micro SD card in my BlackBerry Storm that has 8 gigs on it. That still ain't nothing compared to what's in every single cell of your body. This is how it works. We start by straightening the helix to form a ladder whose outer banisters, as it were, are formed from two continuous strands of sugar molecules known as deoxyribose. From each is suspended the sequence of CGAT chemicals known as nucleic acids that grip together in the middle to form the ladder steps, 3 billion in all. The initials of deoxyribose sugar banisters and the nucleic acid chemicals of the steps give the technical term DNA. And then he has a really nice, pretty little version of this. This memorably simple and elegant structure is perfectly suited to the necessity of replicating the trillion times compressed information every time the cell divides to form two daughter cells. First, the double helix splits down the middle, and the stubs of the half steps on either side each now form a complementary sequence of letters. These stubs then form the template on which the cell builds a further complementary strand, so one double helix becomes two, or as Crick and Watson described it in the most important scientific paper in the history of biology, we imagine that prior to duplication, the bonds connecting the two half-steps are broken, and the two chains unwind and separate. The latter, as it were, splits down the middle. Each chain then acts as a template for the formation onto itself of a new companion chain, so that eventually we shall have two pairs of chains where we only had one before. However, the sequence of the pairs will have been duplicated exactly. Crick and Watson's economical prose does not begin to do justice to the staggering logistics of this process. With up to 4 million new cells being created in the body every second, 1,000 enzymes swarm down the double helix like a team of readers, systematically plowing through the volumes of Webster's dictionary, copying each of the 3 billion CGAT chemicals in precisely the right sequence, and then stringing them all together again. Think about that. When you think about the wonder of what is taking place inside your body at any point in time, this is wonder that Darwin never had any idea of. And this is wonder that captured my mind when I was a biology student and I completed that major. In fact, one of the dumbest things I've ever done. I've done lots of dumb things in life, and here's one of the dumbest things that ever happened. And maybe if I can help somebody else to avoid this. I was just at home one day, my senior year in college, and the phone rang. And it was the registrar's department. And the registrar wanted to know whether I wanted a BA in Bible or a BS in biology, because I had completed the work required for both. I had passed my senior boards as a biology major. That was quite an experience. I remember I and one of my fellow students, as we sat outside waiting for our turn, took our heart rates, and I think I was doing about 140 beats per minute, and I wasn't doing anything. That's how nervous we were. I ought to be young again. But I passed my boards. I was department fellow in anatomy and physiology. I was a good biology student. And I was also a good Bible student. And I completed both majors. And the next year, finished my minor in Greek. And I did something dumb. Because I wasn't given any time to think about it. Graduation was coming up. They needed to know whether I wanted the BA or the BS. So they just called me on the phone. They didn't say, come in, let's talk about it, let's consider what your future plans are, what would be better, just which one do you want? And I chose the wrong one. I chose BA in Bible. I should have taken that BS in biology with a major in Bible. Because going into seminary, it didn't matter what the bachelor's was in. That didn't do anything whatsoever. And so that was a dumb thing. If you're getting ready to graduate and you've done something like that, take some time to think. I have wished so many times I could have gone back and changed that, but I couldn't. So I took the BA instead of the BS. But I still completed all the work for it, and I just don't have anything to show for it along those lines. Anyway. In that senior year, I had, as I mentioned in my closing statement, I raised 35,000 Drosophila melanogaster fruit flies studying the white eye gene. There are four chromosome pairs. The fourth one's sort of irrelevant, but in Drosophila. And I remember right where the white locus was. And it was extensive work. It took many, many hours to do it. But I obviously knew something about genetics. And in fact, had fought that battle for many, many years in public high school. I remember my sophomore year in high school, I wrote a 52-page paper in my biology class on the subject of creationism and evolution. I had had a biology teacher in high school that I was good friends with. In fact, my daughter got to have him his last year of teaching, and I got to have him in his first year of teaching, which I found ironic. But I was given the best arguments from the evolutionary perspective. And even in a Christian college, I was the only non-evolutionist in that group. And so we would go out on limnology expeditions. I remember once paddling around in Montezuma as well, up in the Montezuma National Monument. It's halfway between here and Flagstaff approximately, that general area. And I was always arguing the issues with everybody, including my professors. Even though I was at a Christian school, all the professors were theistic evolutionists, or just evolutionists with a little bit of theism slapped on the top, basically. And so when I graduated, I knew what the arguments were. And that's what I was trying to talk about in my closing statement, was I had taken the time to read Dawkins' book. And I knew enough about genetics to realize that he kept pounding away that mutation has to give a greater advantage to the one carrying the mutation than the regular genotype would, or you're just messing things up and it wouldn't work. So this is a small step micromutation. I realized then, and I didn't read any books about this from the other perspective, that doesn't work. And today, it works even less than it did when I read that first in 1985, because now we've realized, especially since the Genome Project, that the whole idea of small micromutations just doesn't work. The big news, because I remember when they started the Genome Project and everybody's going, oh, we're gonna unravel the very secrets of life. You know what they found out? A house fly has about 17,000 genes. We have about 25,000. Most of them are the same. We've mapped the entire human genome. And we found out that, you know, the 43 volumes of Webster's Dictionary that I just read about, 42 volumes of them don't code for anything. And so you've got one volume worth of pretty much the same genes. And yet, when they're in a fly, they create a fly. When they're in a human, they create a human. When they're in a dog, they create a dog. And we don't really know why. And the big mystery has only gotten more mysterious the more we've learned. Evidently, there has to be some kind of massive intercontextuality between all these genes. to make a man and a fly a fly. Wonder where that comes from. And that the book that I was talking about, Why Us, goes into the decade of the brain and the burgeoning of neuroscience and the mapping of the brain and the fact that we don't get why, you know, when you look at a chair, they can sit there now and map your brain. And then when they ask you to think about what a chair looks like, they can map your brain. And basically they haven't really, I mean, they know where the sight areas are and the hearing areas are and stuff like that. But the idea of the sensation of a chair, I'm sitting in a chair right now and I'm sort of swinging back and forth a little bit. It's a little annoying to people if we're putting this on the web, but we won't be, so it doesn't matter. But I happen to know this particular chair is my old office chair, and so it wobbles some, and it's a little worn out. You know, it's not as good as it once was. But I also, I put my hands down here, and there's places where I could have put, we could have put arms on this. I can feel the spots here. We never did because it would run into the thing. But, you know, I know what this chair feels like. And when you scan someone's brain while they're thinking about the sensation of a chair, the feel of a chair, the whole brain lights up. They can't figure out how that works. And they can't figure out how just neurons firing and firing in a certain way in different places creates the sensation of a chair. The sensation of a smell, of an experience, of a memory. In other words, they didn't find the human mind by mapping the human brain. Just like they didn't find the answer to why mankind is mankind and why stuff develops where it develops. The more we learn about this stuff, the more we recognize, the less we know, in essence. And what I was emphasizing with Dan is that it must be so difficult to be a naturalistic materialist and look at this stuff. And you can see its order, you can see its design, you can see that these structures have a particular purpose, but you must dogmatically separate that from there being any intelligent design. You have to have stupid design. Which doesn't make any sense. There's no such thing as stupid design. Oh, well, yes, you have it in crystals. No, we're not talking about that kind of random design. We're talking about informational, purposeful design. We can see it there. It's natural for us to see it there. And it's glorious to the person who isn't suppressing the knowledge of God within him, but of those who are, it must be a royal bummer. It truly must be. So there's so much more we could talk about there, but those are some of the things that came up in the debate, which you'll get to listen to in just a matter of time. Right, Rich? In MP3 format and then watch in MP4 format down the road and the DVDs and things like that. And I, again, extremely thankful for the opportunity of engaging these kinds of subjects. And I really hope that people will be blessed by that material for a long time to come. It truly is a privilege to do it. Thank you for listening to The Dividing Line today. Lord willing, we will be back on Thursday afternoon. Maybe by then, some of you may have been able to pick up some of the MP3s, might have some comments, some questions. Maybe some of you that were there would like to call in and discuss it a week after it took place or whatever else. Maybe something will happen between now and then we'll need to talk about. Who knows? That's the way The Dividing Line goes. We'll see you on Thursday. God bless.
Stand up for the truth and won't you live for the Lord? 'Cause we're pounding on, pounding.
The Dividing Line has been brought to you by Alpha and Omega Ministries. If you'd like to contact us, call us at 602-973-4602 or write us at P.O. Box 37106, Phoenix, Arizona 85069. You can also find us on the World Wide Web at aomin.org. That's aomin.org, where you'll find a complete listing of James White's books, tapes, debates, and tracks. Join us again this Thursday afternoon at 4 p.m. for The Dividing Line.